Hello there and welcome to IASB Update. This is a short podcast outlining the events of the November 2014 IASB meeting held at here at 30 Cannon Street in London. My name is Chris Welsh, I'm Communications Manager of the IFRS Foundation. I'm joined here today by Stephen Cooper, who's a member of the IASB, and Alan Tashira, who's Senior Technical Director here at the IASB. Thank you very much for joining me again, gentlemen. Just a fairly short update this month, I believe. But to start off, Stephen, we're going to talk about insurance contracts.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. We had just one session on insurance this month, and in fact, no decisions were taken by the board. So I guess there's not a great deal for me to report on. However, it was a very important session. And in fact, we invited some members of the European CFO Forum to come in and present to the board or discuss with the board approaches that we might take for dealing with participating contracts. The CFO Forum have produced what some have called an alternative proposal for participating contracts. In fact, it's not really alternative at all. It is particular approaches to participating contracts that the board has discussed on several occasions in the past, going all the way back to the exposure draft for the so-called unlocking of the margin. Nevertheless, many in the industry have particular interest in the treatment of participating contracts. It's been the subject of board discussion now for several months. The industry and others who are interested in this have also been very much focused on this issue. So we thought it was important that the board fully understood the views of some of these insurers, and particularly the CFO Forum and others that have indicated general support for this approach. So the approach is to do with OCI, and in particular the book yield methodology that the board's discussed in the past, and it also concerns the unlocking of the contractual service margin, particularly for what we call the shareholder share of the underlying asset returns, but also for options and guarantees. So the paper itself that was produced by the CFO Forum was a board paper. Interested parties can download it from the website and see the full text of this thing. I won't go now through what that says, but suffice to say that we had a very useful discussion. The board asked many, many questions on the methodology, getting into some detail, perhaps rather more detail than was presented in the paper itself. There was significant discussion about OCI and book yield, about the CSM, and particularly the treatment of options and guarantees. As I said, no decisions were taken within this process. The board will come back to this in the coming months. We don't currently plan to have a session on insurance next month, but we're going to take our time to think about not only the views of the CFO Forum, but also all of the other educational material that we've looked at over the previous months related to participating contracts. And we will then come to decision-making sessions early in 2015, when we will finalize the board's proposals, the board's view regarding accounting for participating contracts. So that's what we're doing on insurance.
Good stuff. Thank you very much. Alan, moving on, emission trading schemes.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Just a small amount on emission trading schemes this month. But what's important about this is it hasn't been at our board table for a few years now. The history of this project is that we had an interpretation that was issued in 2004 and then withdrawn in 2005. We then did some work on trying to develop a standard for this, and ended up suspending the project in about 2010. So emission trading schemes have not gone away, but and part of our agenda consultation process, with a lot of feedback, indicated that we needed to bring this onto our research program, because it's important to try and anticipate what the right accounting is for these types of schemes. In a way, for those following the Rate Regulated Activities project, there are some similarities between the way emission trading schemes operate and rate regulation. And one of the particular characteristics, of course, is that not every scheme's the same. And so what our challenge is finding common threads in different schemes around the world, so we can pull out and identify what an appropriate accounting treatment might be. So there are two papers that people can download and have a look at. The first was a bit of a refresher on some types of schemes that we have operating. We see references to things like cap and trade schemes, for example. But we also know that we have other, I guess broadly speaking, emission management programs where people are paid amounts to not cut down trees, for example. So there are lots of different types of schemes. Some where people are given credits in advance, some where they are not given credits but have to settle up at the end. So there are all sorts of differences in these. The intention is for us to do some more development work on this with a view to getting a discussion paper out next year. And we've started to at least tease out some of the accounting issues. The difficulty has always been about making sure that we understand the nature of the asset and in particular the liability in each of these schemes. We're also going to have a look at, I'll call it the unit of account and or unit of presentation, but some plans to at least start to think about presenting assets and liabilities together, because a lot of people think of this as being a scheme that operates and perhaps goes in and out of the money. So you can either account for it as one thing, or else you can account for the two separate components, the asset and liability, but perhaps put them together. So whenever we develop a standard, we have to think very carefully about whether we allow netting or offsetting of items. And that's one possibility to think about. So again, early stages, we're working very closely with the IPSASB, which is the public sector equivalent of us, because governments issue these things and we want to try and get parity in the accounting if we can.
Sure. Good stuff. Thank you very much. Moving on, Stephen, the conceptual framework.
Yes, the board discussed a number of sweep issues related to prior discussions in preparation for publishing an exposure draft. However, there was one more significant issue that was discussed, which is the treatment and measurement of transaction costs within the measurement section of the proposed exposure draft. This has been a controversial area in financial reporting in the past, particularly whether transaction costs arising on the purchase of an asset should be included within the carrying value and part of the measurement of that asset. If an asset, or indeed a liability, is at current value, then I think the answer is clear, and the board was pretty clear on this, that you wouldn't include transaction costs. So for example, if an asset or a liability is at fair value, the costs of acquiring the asset or the costs of transferring the liability wouldn't be included. That doesn't preclude the board from using, for example, fair value less cost to sell, but then that would be a different measurement basis. The difficult bit is when you measure something at historic cost, and what should you do with transaction costs in that situation? And there are very much two schools of thought about this, whether the transaction costs should be included in the overall cost of the asset and therefore amortized, depreciated over the asset's life, or whether transaction costs don't actually relate to the measurement of the asset, whether they are payment for services, for professional fees and the like, for services that have been acquired and consumed in the process of acquiring the asset. That type of thinking would suggest that one should expense transaction costs as they arise. Current practice in IFRS under historic cost measurement is often to capitalize and include these transaction costs as part of the asset. But then under IFRS 3, for example, we don't include the transaction costs within the measurement of the assets and goodwill arising in a business combination. So it's a controversial area, and that was also reflected in the voting of the board, because whilst 9 members agreed with the staff proposal, in particular to include transaction costs in historic cost measures, not to expense them, 5 board members disagreed with that proposal. So I've no doubt this will be an interesting area when we come to the exposure draft, and I'll look forward to seeing everybody's views on the treatment of transaction costs in all of the various comment letters. But an interesting discussion should people be interested in looking at the board papers or indeed listening to the board discussion.
Excellent. Thank you, Stephen. And last but not least, Alan, moving on to the disclosure initiative.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. The fairly big discussion this month. We had a look at a few issues, and one to do with formatting of information, another to do with cross-referencing, and perhaps the biggest issue of all was materiality. So if I have a look at the formatting section, one of the things we often ask ourselves is whether we should be in the business of prescribing formats, for example, in financial statements, or whether that's a general area that we don't really need to participate or contribute to. But the board has decided, and I think followed the staff recommendation, that sometimes format does matter. There's actually some evidence, for example, that when there are lots of dimensions to information, such as a maturity analysis, or you've got quite a bit of information about something like a reconciliation, that it's actually better and easier to consume or read if it's in a tabular format. And the board, that's been reflected by board decisions historically, where we have specified that you prepare and needs to present using a tabular format unless there's a better way of presenting. So we're going to have quite high level guidance on that, so identify when perhaps some particular formats might be easier for people to read and actually identify material information. We'll also have a look at developing some educational material. It's a little bit like the basic communication principles we discussed last month. Again, it's not clear that the board needs to do any standards level activity, but there are certainly many jurisdictions that we believe would welcome some educational material to help explain some of the consequences of different types of formats, the same way we're looking at communication. So we expect to develop some educational material too. Second area we looked at was cross-referencing, and that's the situation where, for example, even today, in relation to risk, one of our standards, IFRS 7, allows you to present the information either in the notes to the financial statements or in the management commentary accompanying the financial statements. And we had a look to see whether or not we should have a more general principle about that. What the board's been concerned about is that you shouldn't separate the information so much that it's actually difficult to find things that ought to belong together. We don't want to end up pulling apart the financial statements and notes to the point that they become just a bunch of cross-references. But on the other hand, we do actually see within annual reports, for example, some sections that might deal with executive or director remuneration, so the remuneration report. And rather than have the separate legal requirements in a jurisdiction plus our IFRS requirements separated, in some sense artificially, perhaps it's best to put the two together and then incorporate by cross-reference. Yeah. So what the board has agreed to do is that we will have a general principle for disclosing outside of financial statements, that these are constraints. It's going to be limited, so it should be within what we call the annual report, which is essentially a single document. When I say single document, anybody goes through websites looking at annual reports, for example, might actually see it split out into four or five PDFs or some little sections, but it is clearly defined as being one report. And it'll be important that all sections of that report have to be available on the same terms and conditions and at the same time. So essentially, if you think about a paper-based world, within the annual report, you're okay to move things around. Second thing is that the reason for actually moving the material should be to make the annual report itself more understandable, and that's by bringing together, for example, in the risk case, two expressions of risk, perhaps one risk, some risk factors to do with regulatory management and the other to do with financial reporting, and you're bringing those together. So it makes sense because the whole report actually becomes more understandable. And another constraint is you can't basically, as I said, decimate the financial statements. They've still got to remain understandable and fairly presented. So the presumption is you start whatever we require in IFRS in terms of the main primary financial statements and the notes, that's the starting point. You don't want to upset that balance to the point that what you're looking at is a whole lot of cross-references. So the idea is to give enough flexibility without undermining, I think, the credibility of IFRS statements. Then the last issue was materiality, which is we've been spent about 6 months on this part of the project. And the board made three decisions, essentially. The first is that we're going to retain the existing definition of material or materiality with some of the framework, but we are going to tidy up and make changes. We expand a little bit on the definition in IS1, one of our standards, and then also in IS8. So two of our standards actually expand a little bit. So they, for some people, it looks like they're different definitions or marginally. We're going to bring all those together so they align. So we will make changes to the wording to bring those together and make sure all the parts are aligned. Having said that, there were three issues in the definition of material which raised some concerns to some people. One is the threshold, and it's whether or not information could affect a reader's decision or whether it probably would. They're different thresholds, and our threshold, the word we use at the moment, is could. And some perceive that as being too low a threshold, because as long as anybody in the room might make that decision, then that means it becomes material. And in other jurisdictions, particularly in the US, they have a higher threshold. So that was something we were asked to have a look at. The two other areas are, one is focusing and making sure that the users of financial statements are clearly identified and targeted, the definition of material. And there's a more of a neutrality issue. At the moment, our definition talks about whether something should be excluded rather than saying include or exclude information. But the dilemma is that the definition seems to work reasonably well by itself. Mm. And you can change and actually cause more problems by changing the wording and create more uncertainty. So we are going to put in our discussion paper, we do have an alternative definition that's been developed, and it's in the staff paper from this month. We'll put that into the principles of disclosure discussion paper, and then seek some feedback on that to see whether we should leave it as it is or potentially expose that when we get to the exposure draft phase. The other two small pieces are, we are going to expand the explanatory bits of the definition a little bit, just to re-emphasise the basic principles or characteristics of materiality, and that there are things like, you don't just look at something in isolation, you have to look at it in the context of the financial statements. Those things are actually in the wording at the moment, but we're just going to tidy that up. The third leg, which is an important one, is that a lot of jurisdictions, a lot of preparers and users would like us to develop more guidance. We debated whether that guidance should be inside a standard, inside educational material, or, as the board decided, in a practice statement. And by developing it as a practice statement, in the same way management commentary exists, it's part of the bound volume, so people have got it as a resource. It's not part of IFRS, but a jurisdiction can, if they choose to, decide to incorporate that into their local requirements or regulation. Okay. And that allows the less mature, those jurisdictions have got perhaps less development in the concept of materiality to draw on that if they choose to. And that's what our proposal is going to be. Other than that, we did have a small sweep issue on, we've got some amendments that we're publishing on the 18th of December in relation to IS1, which are designed to give a bit more flexibility to preparers on financial statements and help improve communication aspects.
Great, thank you very much. Got a busy December, I believe. In anything else you particularly want to flag up ahead of next month's meeting?
December is mainly, the disclosure initiative is back again. We're talking about non-GAAP numbers or non-IFRS numbers, so that people saw it, so alternative performance measures and so on. Quite a controversial area, so that's coming up in December. The other highlights, perhaps even peeking ahead a little bit, so people anticipate what's coming up. We're not expecting to see insurance back until February at this stage, so don't anticipate December or January for insurance. And leases, January is our big target for that. We have quite a range of issues coming back in January. So I guess the biggest ones will be some of the research program and disclosure initiative in December, and then on to leases January, insurance February.
Okay, so plenty to look forward to over the next few months. Okay, thank you very much. Before we leave you today, I should add that all views expressed during this broadcast are those of the individuals and do not necessarily represent those of the IASB. But that's it for November. We'll join you again in December. The meeting of the IASB takes place between the 14th and the 18th. So we should have another podcast for you shortly after that. In the meantime, a more detailed written summary of the discussion is available via ifrs.org. If you go to the Stay Informed tab along the top navigation, as are all of the board papers discussed during this podcast. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll be back next month.